Your Steve Jones Show podcast will start shortly. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Brewers Outlet, your beverage supermarket on Reagan Street in Sunbury. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right. Happy Friday, everybody. Great to have you with us. Brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Imports, domestics, microbrews, best selection of beer anywhere. Wine coolers, water, soft drinks, snacks. They roast their peanuts fresh and hot every day in the pickle bar. Led by the barrels and the dills, indeed, second to none. Only a Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Stock up for the weekend now. I know next Wednesday when I come in for the Purdy Memorial Golf Tournament, I will be stocking up before I get out of there. Have to. Brewers Outlet's our place to go. And I am in the Sunbury Motors studio, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Saquon Barkley now a member of the New York Giants. The Giants, look, there are a lot of ways the Giants could have gone. But Eli Manning really, you know, you can talk about Ahmad Bradshaw all you want. The Giants have not really had a top-line running back for Eli Manning since Tiki Barber. And now they have that. So for the Giants, and in a league where you can go from last to the playoffs, I'm not saying they're going to bypass the Eagles. The Eagles are defending Super Bowl champions with everybody back. That's a heck of a football team, right? For 2018, they're a heck of a football team. The Giants can make the playoffs with this team because they picked Barkley last night. Because for the Giants, they have to look at it this way. They ended up getting two first-round picks last night if Odell Beckham Jr. is healthy. Because now they're going to start the season with Odell Beckham Jr. and Saquon Barkley, two players they didn't have either at all or the vast majority of last season. And for Eli Manning, that's what he's looking for. Baker Mayfield at number one. Interesting. I'm not a big believer in the hype part of it because I believe Drew Brees has dispelled that. I mean, Drew Brees has won a Super Bowl, has been a legitimately great NFL quarterback. He is not a big man. So when people talk about Mayfield's hype, I'm not really, you know, it doesn't hurt you. Obviously, being tall helps you, but it doesn't hurt you either. The only two areas I like his swagger. I like his confidence. I think it connects with everybody else on the football team. There are two areas, if I were the Browns, I'd be concerned. Now, one is a plus, and then one part of it's a plus. Baker Mayfield is a great front runner. Once he gets to the lead on somebody, boom, normally he can put them away. Big plus. Well, now let's go to the minus. Right? Who's he ever brought? Who did he ever bring Oklahoma back against? He had three shots in the Rose Bowl, couldn't do it. He had against Iowa State at home, couldn't do it. And here's the other part that is a concern if I were a Browns fan. Probably the two most complicated defenses he faced last year probably would be Georgia, but the one that plays more like an NFL-style defense is Texas, and he has not played well against Texas. In fact, Texas thoroughly confused him. That would bother me. That said, it's a jumbled quarterback draft. Denzel Ward was a surprise at 4. And, of course, it finished out with Lamar Jackson, an intriguing pick to end the first round. Wow. We'll come back. We're going to talk with Greg Pickle, PennLive.com, and the Patriot News in a moment as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Party time, game time, or just fun time. Doesn't matter what time it is, because it's Brewers Outlet time. The Beverage Supermarket has the area's largest beer selection. Imports, microbrews, ciders, and domestics. Pick from over 100 ice-cold 12-packs and dozens of 24-ounce singles. Soda, snacks, hot sauces, fresh roasted peanuts. Make it one-stop party shopping, and don't forget the pickle bar. So whatever you're celebrating or just doing it up, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury, wants to see you. And thank you for your years of patronage.
Today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury. The Beverage Supermarket imports domestic microbrews, best selection of beer anywhere, wine coolers, water, soft drinks, snacks. They roast their peanuts fresh and hot every day, and the pickle bar is indeed second to none. We'll call this your draft edition of your weekend. NFL draft rounds 2 and 3 tonight. Expect Deshaun Hamilton, Mike Gesicki to be off the board before the night is over with. Stanley Cup playoffs last night, Pens down 2-0 to the Caps, then rallied for 3 unanswered goals, 1. The Vegas Golden Knights blew out San Jose last night. And Milwaukee beat the Celtics last night to force a Game 7. All right. Greg Pickle, PennLive.com, joins us. And also the Patriot News. Greg, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Hey, Steve. Good to be on.
Saturday, great crowd on hands, about 71,000 estimated. James Franklin was rather blunt about it. He said, look, it was, you know, plain vanilla as to what they did. But what were your general thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think that when Penn State obviously goes through its 14 spring practices, they learn a lot more in each of those 14 as opposed to the blue-white game. It, of course, has boiled down and really just a chance for the guys to get out and experience Beaver Stadium, how the team lines up at the field, everything that they do once they get into the huddle and come out of the locker room and all of that. So, it's more of a dress or a rehearsal, I guess you could say, for the season. We don't see a whole lot, of course, but I thought it was a good day. The key always, Steve, is that your guys stay healthy, and as far as we know, Penn State's guys did exactly that over the course of the four quarters at Beaver Stadium. And, you know, I thought Sean Clifford looked pretty good. I thought that Micah Parsons and Nick Tarburton both showcased the fact that they have the kind of skill sets that might be able to help Penn State sooner rather than later. So I thought that was encouraging to see. And overall, you know, I just thought it was a good day for the program. There really wasn't anything that, you know, stood out or shocked you in any sort of way. Trace McSorley, 10 of 14, looking good and accurate as always. And like I said, I thought Clifford was good. Zach McPherson had a nice day with 3 pass breakups. A couple of those other guys back in the secondary looked good. So overall, I have to think it was encouraging for the Lions as they head into a busy time of year for recruiting.
Also, Jesse Lucchetta, another one of those linebackers that was involved. He seemed to be in several different areas of the field Saturday.
Yeah, I think he's a guy that, you know, I personally underestimated coming into Penn State. He's a guy that's gotten a little bit bigger, a little bit stronger, and a little bit faster since his senior season wrapped up at out in Erie. And I just look at him and think of another guy that could play right away and certainly help Penn State on special teams, if not elsewhere. I just think he moves very well, much better than I thought he did, and his tape looks really good. So we'll have to wait and see how it all plays out. But he was impressive on Saturday as well. And, you know, Isaiah Humphreys and Trent Gordon and Zach Coons all seem to have pretty productive springs as well. So when you put it all together, Steve, I know that, you know, it's not always the case that guys play, you know, their first season. But as James Franklin said, the January enrollment factor certainly gets these guys a leg up when it comes to summer camp. And I don't know, I'm starting to get more and more convinced we might see a bunch of them play. Maybe not all 7, all 6, but a bunch of them get on the field early on in September. Excuse me.
Which then brings us to some of the interviews. You had a chance to talk with some of the people afterward. What struck you about some of the conversations you heard in the media room?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple things stood out. Ricky Rahne, obviously, is a guy that, you know, the one impression I continue to get of him, Steve, is that there's not much that frazzles a guy. There's not much that freaks him out or makes him get worked up. Or, you know, he's a very calm, cool, and collected guy. And we saw that with Joe Moorhead, too. And I think that for this offense to be at its peak, obviously you need good player production, but you need also a coach that's able to sit back and diagnose things. And if things aren't going well, be able to see the big picture. So to me, that was probably the biggest takeaway. Just listening to him talk, obviously, you know, he was complimentary of Matt Kippenhammer, the offensive line, and so forth. But just listening to him talk in general, I was really struck by the fact that this is a guy that is in the Joe Moorhead, in the James Franklin, you know, kind of family when you talk about just reacting to things and the way guys handle the environment and the emotions and the pressure of all of it. I was really just impressed by how he conducted himself after the Fiesta Bowl and then how he conducted himself at the Blue-White game on Saturday. Penn State has a star in him. There's no question about it.
Greg, when you look at the caliber of athlete out there across the board, what are you seeing with Penn State football now as opposed to maybe 5 years ago?
Oh, there's no question it's skyrocketed. I mean, this is a group now that, you know, the teams that came before had a lot of older veteran guys that were kind of crafty. They'd been around for a while. They had learned a lot, grown a lot, and played a lot of football. But there weren't too many young guys that could contribute from day one. And now you have a bunch of those guys that can play from day one, mixed in with some veterans, mixed in with some guys who were redshirt freshmen that are now able to take the next step. And, you know, they hope to play a whole bunch this summer and then fall. So, I mean, it's night and day. There's no question about it. It's now for Penn State. They are playing with the kind of athletes across the board that the top programs, that the college football playoff contenders, et cetera, across the country have. And I think that you've seen James Franklin and his staff continue to recruit better and better, and that's led to, of course, more highly rated players and more highly productive players. So, you know, it's not to take anything away from the guys that have been in the program beforehand, but certainly this group now is special, and the last few have been as well.
There, of course, is also a major recruiting weekend. You're able to get 71,000 people into Beaver Stadium for a spring game, which was number 4 among all spring games this particular year. Tell us a little bit about the recruiting component.
Yeah, good day for Penn State, Steve. You got Caden Wallace, the 4-star guard from Princeton, New Jersey, to verbally commit to the program while in town for an unofficial visit. I think that that was only a matter of time before he pulled the trigger. Penn State has long sat in good shape with him, and it was just, you know, he went out to Oklahoma, and I think he wanted to see some other schools, but at the end of the day, he visited Penn State more than any other school, and it really wasn't even close comparatively. So I just think that that's a good win for the Lions to get the offensive line class off and running. And then when you look at the totality of the visitors, I mean, it was a good group. Two of the top players in the class of 2020, Julian Fleming, a receiver, and Brian Bressio, a defensive lineman, were both on hand. You had Zach Harrison, one of the top three players in the country in the class of 2019. Xavier Truss, a big offensive lineman from Rhode Island. I could go on and on and on. We could fill the rest of the hour talking about the number of guys that were there. But for Penn State, it was probably the best gathering of kids they've ever had. Don't get me wrong, some of the Ohio State and Michigan visitor lists in the past under James Franklin have been really star-studded, but this group was far and away the largest number of highly ranked kids that Penn State's ever had on campus across multiple classes.
Right now, but they're also in an interesting spot because I think you get a sense that, like, with this class, they have to go a little further, maybe a little wider net this time. Is that fair?
Yeah, it certainly is. It's not to say the Mid-Atlantic and Pennsylvania specifically is down or really bad this particular year, but there's just not as many guys out there to offer nearby within that 300-mile radius that James Franklin talks about. Now, look, like a couple of the guys we mentioned, Xavier Truss is a Rhode Island kid. Wallace is from New Jersey. There's a couple defensive backs, Tyler Rudolph and Marquise Wilson from Connecticut, that are high on the board and that were in town. Andre White, the linebacker from Harrisburg. There are some nearby guys, but I think that two things really stand out, Steve. The first one is that there's not as many, top flight players at Penn State once in this region in this cycle. But the other factor of it too is Penn State can recruit nationally now. If they want to go get the best players in some of these other states and try and get into Florida and Texas, Missouri, Georgia, etc., they can. And that's something they really haven't been able to do before. But when you win and when you got coaches that have connections all over the country, which Penn State does, you're able to do a little bit different recruiting wise than maybe you have in the past.
There are some people that are wondering that while they go through the weekend and they get one verbal commitment, they're expecting 3, 4, 5. I mean, this is an entire process. Explain the process, and if someone has a question as to why it appears on the surface to be slower, why?
Yeah, I think that the new recruiting rules have changed everything. So previously, you'd have guys that had to wait until the start of their senior season, August 31st, September 1st, to go on official visits. They couldn't go see schools on the school's dime until the start of their senior year. Well, now with the new NCAA rule that allows recruits to go see campus on the school's dime for official visits, between April 1 and May 31, it really changes the game. Kids that might have committed now and wanted to take official visits in the fall while they're committed to a school, well, those kids are now waiting and say, okay, I'll take all my official visits between now and the end of June, and then what I'll do is I'll make my decision before my senior season starts and take a visit to the school that I pick sometime during the fall. So the calendar's really changed entirely, Steve. Like I said, it used to be that kids would commit by now, but the spring game would always be a jump-off point. And I do think they'll get one every year. That's been pretty standard under James. But I do think that the slowed-down nature of this is not only due to the fact that Penn State might have a bit of a smaller class than normal, but also the new recruiting rules are slowing down commitments across the country in general.
What about the dynamic? And you've talked to enough student-athletes, and you've talked to enough parents along the way. What kind of dynamic in the change in the Penn State staffs, like a Jaywan Sider, a Donnie Corley, a Tyler Bowen, for example? Now, what are some of the pluses they bring to the table that recruits and their families like?
Well, Tyler Bowen's just a really relatable guy. All three of them are. I think that's the first thing that jumps out when talking about the new trio of coaches that Penn State has. And Phil Galliano, you can throw him into that group as well, because keep in mind, he was on the staff, but promoted, of course, to an on-field role. So you have four new guys that have really worked hard to learn the Penn State way, learn the James Franklin way, Galliano a lot less than the other three, obviously, because he was already here. But, you have three guys that have really figured it out quickly, and now they're able to sell it to the recruits that they were recruiting in other places. Bowen has relationships all over the place because of his ties in Maryland and also Fordham. Jaywan Sider has Florida on lockdown, and David Corley has been, a nice addition, too. He might not have the high caliber schools on his resume, but he's been all over the place and is a very good and highly respected coach. So, all these guys seem to be very well liked by the current players, and recruits are really starting to warm up to him as well, especially Sider, who's going to do big things for these guys on the recruiting front.
All right. You talked about getting some conversation with Ricky Ronnie in there. What did you think when Brent Pry had his opportunity?
Yeah, I thought that, Brent is what he is. He's not, you know what you're going to get with him. He's going to talk about the grease board. He's going to really drill down on the fundamentals and things like that. I mean, he's not exactly a secret when it comes to what he expects from his guys. He wants them to be fundamentally sound, whether they play defensive tackle or safety, and he wants them to be, responsible for their part of the defense. So he was good as always, not anything too surprising. Obviously, he has his work cut out for him with the linebacker spot and how Penn State's going to really figure that out and make things work there in the middle and outside. But to me, Steve, I think that this might be one of the best groups Brent Pry has to work with. Yes, last year's group was tremendous veteran. It's going to have a number of players drafted, but this one's high on potential if it's low on experience. And it will take some molding, but Penn State has a defensive assistant and a leader in Brent Pry to make that work. And I think that this group has a chance to maybe really turn some heads compared to what things were expected a year ago.
Greg, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time, the talk, and also the insight.
All right, Steve. Always a pleasure. Talk to you guys soon.
Greg Pickle, PennLive.com, Patriot News. Coming up next half hour, Tony Knopp. And later in the show, my brother will join us. Brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sports. Sports Talk, where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. And we're in the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Key, routes 11 and 15 in Humble's Wharf. Very quickly out to the West Coast we go. Tony Knopp, CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, my good friend. It's great to hear you again.
How are you doing, Steve? Long time.
Long time. It's great to hear you. I hope everything is going well on your end.
All is well. Fighting a little bit of a cold, but you'll hear it. Bear with me.
We're just happy to have you here. Let's start with this. The World Cup is coming up. Obviously, the nations will come together, but it's in Russia. There'll be no United States. How do you view that right now? How does the corporate world view it?
It's going to be a very interesting World Cup. Not only is the World Cup in Russia, but the Champions League finals are in Kiev coming up in a couple of weeks here. And, you know, for those who don't follow international soccer all that much, the Russian soccer gangs, which is a real thing, have taken to social media and made it very, very clear that England is not welcome in Russia, either for the Champions League finals or for the World Cup. And without the United States being there, the question is going to be how much of England is going to be there and what kind of focus you're going to see on Mexico. So, for example, you know, Fox paid $1.2 billion for the rights to a lot of the major soccer that happens over the course of the next 12 years. And if you watch, you know, all their commercials are around El Tri, around, you know, Team Mexico. So I think there's not going to be that much coverage in the United States, to be totally honest. I don't know if people are going to care all that much. And I'm actually really worried about the security issue there. I talked to two of the top five major sponsors of the Champions League and World Cup, and they're just not sending people. One of them is a major beer brand who usually sends between 1,000 and 2,000 people a year to the Champions League finals. They're sending 100 people. And the other is a major technology company that is anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000 people at the World Cup, and they said they'll have maybe a dozen people there. It's just not safe.
Wow.
I expected it to be bad, but when they told me that, I thought, wow, I don't know who's going to go then.
Well, the part about the Russian gang versus, obviously, England, I knew about. Hadn't talked about it on the show, but knew about. This goes far deeper, I think, than anybody realizes.
It's going to be incredibly dangerous and very, very nasty. I mean, a quick Google search or YouTube search to show you what they're already doing to each other. And the idea of, you know, an English team possibly being in Kiev for the Champions League if Liverpool holds on, and then England going to the World Cup, it's going to be, you know, people shouldn't be leaving the major cities. And even at that point, I don't know if I'd want to be traveling around the England contingent, to be honest. And the reality is, when you have a World Cup in a place like Russia, you know, similar to having it in South Africa, you're really, really relying on those European countries. And England travels better than almost all of them, especially if the team is good. So you're literally taking one of your top five fan bases and saying, you're not welcome here. It's going to have a major economic impact on the World Cup.
Plus, you already don't have Italy.
Right. You don't have Italy, you don't have the Dutch. You're basically saying England's not welcome. So you're relying on, you know, the German contingent, the Spanish contingent, the team's getting a little old there, to bring enough economic impact and economic influence to you. You know, the Americans aren't going out there. The team's not even in it. So it's going to be a really fascinating World Cup. I mean, I appreciate the fact that they're trying to make it a global game and that, you know, teams like Egypt and, you know, teams from Asia that probably aren't in the top 30 are getting in. But now it's getting to the point where they're kind of cutting off their nose to spite their face, you know. The Dutch are the runners-up two of the last three times. They're not even in the tournament.
Right. There's something interesting going on, and it's with Big Ten Network. Outside the Big Ten footprint, Comcast has dropped the Big Ten Network. Now, you and I both know that 10-year deal that they signed, it's up this year. This is year 10, so this is the 10-year deal. And you and I both know that the negotiations continue to be stalled, that next will be the Big Ten footprint. I wouldn't be surprised if the first couple of weeks of the football season there's no Big Ten Network on Comcast. That's just an opinion. It's not fact. What in today's cable market, where you're still getting into 70 million plus homes, that's not a small number.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's the effect of these negotiations? What do leagues want, or a league network want, and what does Comcast want?
Well, you know, the problem is they're trying to figure out how to measure what's happening right now. I mean, the reality is they still haven't found an effective way to understand who's watching across multiple, you know, viewership, whether it's you're watching on your tablet, whether you're watching it mobile, or whether you're watching it in a traditional sense. So even their ratings right now aren't really something that they can rely on. And we're all hearing about cord cutting and people getting away from live TV, but, you know, sports continues to maintain. You know, the one thing that's going to be interesting to watch with the Big Ten Network is they're kind of first here. They were the first ones to set up a regional network that was as powerful as it is, and a regional sports network that was as powerful as it is. And so, you know, the Pac-12 and others have kind of piggybacked off of that. It'll be interesting to see how well they hold the line because, you know, a lot of people believe, you know, there's just no way I'm going to miss Penn State football for the first month if I'm on Comcast. Comcast would never do that to me. Well, I'd invite you to come out here and try to catch a Dodger game on Time Warner, who's the number two provider in Southern California. We haven't had Dodger games locally in over two seasons, and the Dodgers went to the World Series last year. So, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a public relations issue here. And the cable companies are already not well-liked. They're not that concerned about you not liking them anymore. What they're more interested about is, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars that are going back and forth in this negotiation and making sure that they're not missing out on how the next generation is going to consume what they're watching. Because, honestly, they don't really even know. And, you know, kudos to the Big Ten Network. I mean, the reality is it's extremely powerful. The fans are very, very loyal. And as people move to a different form and different platform for entertainment, sports has held. So, you know, they know they're sitting on something valuable. I just hope it doesn't affect people in Big Ten country because, you know, that would be a shame. It's, you know, the best time of the year.
Right. No, it's, you know, and that's happened with other groups before. Remember CBS got into a big go-around with Comcast about carriage fees and how much it's going to cost per CBS affiliate on
The biggest nightmare
on the
that's
bill and so forth.
The Houston Rockets and the Houston Astros decided to build their own network because they didn't like the way the negotiations were going with Fox and some of the other major players. And they built their own network, and the two of them said, yeah, there'll be no problem with having both of us, you know, in charge. And what happened? It completely tanked. They ended up suing one another. The games fell off the air for, you know, well over a year between two major market teams. And just now they're back to where they started. They signed an outsourced deal where they have a network company now covering it and handling it for them. So, you know, there's a lot at stake here, and there's a lot of precedent for people who have really messed this up. And, you know, I think a lot of times when we see this, we think, you know, these are major brands, and they know what they're doing, and they're not going to interrupt the football season. But actually, precedent says otherwise.
Well, now I want to bring the Dodger part up, Tony, because you brought that up. I remember a couple of years ago, they had taught somebody said, well, gee, you know, they've got Vin Scully as well as the Dodgers. And they still can't get on. And Scully, to his credit, said, hey, look, my job's to announce the games. It's not my job to, you know, people shouldn't be watching just for me. So what is, in Los Angeles, where the Dodgers are as established a brand as you could possibly ask for, what is the rub? Why can't the two sides come to an agreement?
It just comes down to money. The Dodgers, when they bought, when Guggenheim and the partners bought the Dodgers, you know, the understanding was they put a valuation on that deal, on the network deal, and how much they were going to be able to make both locally and internationally. You know, the Dodgers have aspirations of being an international brand. They believe that they're the number two brand behind the Yankees. And, you know, you and I would laugh about that now because that just hasn't been the case for the last 20 years. But, you know, 1988 and prior, they were the number two brand in baseball. So, you know, they have aspirations to get that back to that point. And, you know, Time Warner is just saying, look, this doesn't add up, right? You're trying to hold the sausage and you're trying to turn our fans against it. So it's gotten to the point now where it's so stale. You know, you go to sports bars around here and there are signs up that say, we don't have Time Warner, you can watch Dodger games. Or we do have Time Warner, you can watch Dodger games, right? It's giving them the opportunity to say, look, Time Warner is going to use this as an example to try to drive new subscribers, and they've dug their feet in the sand. They've already gotten past the publicity backlash for it. It's almost become a normal thing here. And I personally do know people who've converted over so they can watch Dodger games. And I think we're going to have the same kind of chicken at the Big 12 Network, and that's just going to set the precedent for what happens everywhere else because all of these other networks are looking to the Big 12 Network as the gold standard, right? The SEC can talk about how great they are, but the business side for them, it's just not there. They're too reliant on their major network deal, right? And they don't control their own product. So this will be a fascinating one to watch because this isn't just about the Big 12 Network. This is about every major regional network that's come up since they pioneered this.
Okay, let me ask you about the millennial group. And we've talked about this before, but I'll try it in a different vein. You know, you're somebody that's in the ticket business. You're in the business of business. What is it about the millennial group that people, in your opinion, don't get? And are there actually traditional ways of getting media to them that people haven't understood that they're more? I'll give you a good example. A lot of people think you have to have great Wi-Fi in the stadium because millennials want it, and they could care less about it.
They don't care.
When you actually talk to them.
All the studies show that they don't care.
Trying to think with them. So
right.
When you've gone through and done your research, what does it tell you?
Millennials are about experiences, and they're way less about brands, right? It's the reality that we're seeing with them across their ticket buying preferences and where they attend and what they do. You know, we're all still significantly brand-driven based on how advertising has evolved from, you know, the 50s until today. And we're loyal to specific brands for no other reason but just something that we subconsciously understand. But they've been so inundated since the day they were born and had so much access to information that they're not loyal to specific brands. They're actually even less loyal to teams. And that comes from the fact that they've been exposed to entire leagues instead of just the local team on one of their 18 channels. So what they're really struggling with is not how to get millennials to attend when your team is good and when it's neat. You know, you were talking about the 76ers. You know, they've built something that's now crossed over into pop culture, and, you know, millennials attend Sixers games. But what the problem was most highlighted with was we saw with the University of Michigan a few years back when they couldn't get students to even go to the game.
Right?
And that to Generation X and to the baby boomers is alien because, you know, to us, the game is part of a community. We go to all of them, and that's something that we do because they're there. And millennials just say, look, this experience just really isn't that separated from the other experiences that I'm having. When the team is good and unique, I'll go, but otherwise I'm not going to go watch, you know, a crappy team play. And that's been the biggest problem is the actual ticket buying trends have become more about experience than they have become about even the band or even the team playing. Like, people are more interested now in Coachella than even who's on the lineup for Coachella.
Right.
Coachella, for those that don't know, is a very large music festival that happens in Southern California 2 weekends a year. That it's the largest in the world now, and everybody's trying to back up on that. And it's become this large corporate thing where the brands are trying to find a way into the millennials, but the millennials just go because it's become this Woodstock-like getaway for their generation.
Right. Exactly. Now, I'll give you an example. Georgia football 3 years ago. Georgia football.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, 29% no-show rate among students who had already bought tickets.
That's unheard of.
Arizona State, 48%.
Arizona State, I understand. It's, you know, the West Coast, as much as I love it, the West Coast is soft when it comes to football. But for SEC country and Big Ten country to have that happen at Georgia and Michigan, it's absurd. And it's not just absurd. It's something that is a very big problem for, you know, universities who rely on ticketing gate. Like, you know, the 76ers are a lot less reliant on people buying tickets to their events than Georgia and Michigan are. It's just the way it is. You know, universities have moved slower than the leagues have in trending towards activating sponsors around different kinds of things. They really rely on you attending the game, and they haven't yet evolved. And millennials are not going to support them. That's just the reality. They're not going to go unless the team's good. And even if the team's good, if they've been good for a long time and it's not a new experience with, you know, a new superstar that people find enticing, they're not going to go. I mean, USC games, the minute USC lost a game this year, attendance dropped by 15%.
Yep, exactly. Right. Now, if you're advising Jeremy Pruitt of Tennessee, do you tell him to not challenge the fans who didn't show up at your spring game?
I mean, I don't know what the answer is for Tennessee. That was a program that was winning national championships 20 years ago. That has just been a doormat. I mean, one bad hire after another. At what point do you say, look, we've lost a fan base? We've lost an entire generation of a fan base. Because that's happened across the country. I mean, you and I have seen it. Teams that were once, you know, superpowers are just now largely ignored, right? Remember when Seton Hall was a basketball superpower and everybody wanted to go? That's not the case anymore. And Georgetown's getting to that point now, where they used to be a must-see, and they played in the, you know, the large arena where the Caps and the Wizards play, and now, you know, they can't even fill up their local gym.
No. No, and that's exactly right. I got to ask you, the Tiger Woods effect, what has it had, not just on attendance, it's obvious you can see it, what's it had in terms of the money side, the corporate side?
Oh, it's so significant. Golf has been interesting to watch because they're making so much money on the corporate side. Corporate spending is way up. They found a way with golf where if you sponsor a tournament, you actually have to buy network time that aligns with the tournament that you're showing. So it really gives you the opportunity not just to say, all right, my brand is going to be highlighted during play with, you know, however I'm activating it with signage or whatever else, but I'm also going to be dominant on the airwaves across the board. So that's all been good. But the problem golf has is, you know, recreationally, you know, participation has dropped significantly. You know, Dick's Sporting Goods almost went out of business because they bet so heavy on it. Nike pulled out that's of it right. altogether.
Right.
You know, guys like Tiger Woods, as much as, you know, pure golfers say, I don't care to watch Tiger. I don't know why they show him while he's not in contention, while other, you know, younger guys are in contention. Well, they're showing him because he drives people to the range. He drives people to the courses. And the reality is the Top Golf effect, you know, we still don't know if that's going to hold. It's only been a couple of years. So the effect that Tiger's had on the tour has been significant. And the way they're looking at it now isn't so much how do we cash in right now. They're really trying to make sure they don't make the same mistake that when he leaves again, you know, everybody takes off with him.
We knew that the Winter Olympics financially was not going to be great.
Oh,
it turned out that there were a lot of problems along the way, just even with the coverage of the Olympics. Is Tokyo a line in the sand to let us know what direction the Olympics are actually going in?
It'll be interesting because Tokyo hasn't hosted a major live event in decades, right? And so the first thing they're going to have, they're actually going to have the Rugby World Cup coming up here. That's going to be their test run for the Olympics. So we'll see how they do with that. The funny one is, I think I read this correctly, that Paris is already $2 billion or something over their budget. It's still 2024, which are any of us surprised that there's going to be corruption in France overspending against their budget?
Right.
But and they haven't even bought the land for the Olympic Village yet. So it's one of those things where you just fully expect it to happen, but you see the headline and it makes you laugh.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why you've talked so often here about people. Hey, if you want to invest a little bit of money, invest money in. And look, I'm a football, basketball, baseball, hockey, golf guy, whatever. But I completely get why you tell us why. Hey, look, invest a little bit in MLS, for example,
because
they've got a beautiful formula going where they don't have oversized stadiums. They've got great atmospheres. The games don't, or the matches don't take that long, and people have fun.
And they get involved when things go south. So Columbus, the situation in Columbus is awful, right? But the league's involved, and they're going to move that team to Austin. And if they don't, then they're going to solve it in the next year. They're not going to have, you know, a lame duck franchise. I mean, you look at what Major League Baseball did with the Expos. That was a disaster. It was a total disaster. And the same thing happened with the Supersonics moving out of Seattle. You know, at least MLS has enough control from the top that they're making sure that these things don't happen. And look, the reality is I think the leagues that people are investing in the most and have the most growth are the MLS and the NBA. I mean, the reality is if the NCAA changes do eventually come, and I think that's, you know, coming sooner rather than later, the ability for them to create a G League and really start to saturate, you know, smaller markets with, you know, teams that are integrated with what's happening with the big club. You know, players are going up and down with more regularity than what's happening with, you know, minor league baseball. I just think the NBA, you know, the sky is the limit for that league. It's become an international game. They're going to be able to make it even more localized. You can see the ratings are going up while everybody else's are going down. Its sponsorship spending is basically maxed out. If you want to be a major sponsor for the NBA, you can't. There's no spots left for you.
I'm sure we can't get an accurate gauge on what kind of market Vegas actually is, but a year ago today they had no players. they are Pacific Division champions. They swept the Kings in four games. They're into the conference semifinal. Is this as interesting and in some ways as remarkable a sports story as we have seen, not only from the on-ice but to the management, to the ticket part?
I think the NHL got a little over-aggressive with their draft, and now you have Seattle making the same demands, right? Hey, look, if Vegas gets to be the 2 seed, we get to be the 2 seed in our first year. What's fascinating about Vegas, I've been to a few games out there. I've been to the environment and seen it. It's still a really transient fan base. So, you know, when you go to the games, even with such a hot team, during the regular season, a very large chunk of the fans were from the opposing team, which makes sense because if you're going to go on a road trip to watch the team play, you're going to go to Vegas, right? You're going to fly out of Edmonton in February to go to Las Vegas. So I don't know what the staying power is on it. The only reason I'm cynical about it is because, you know, you and I have been around long enough. We remember when the Anaheim Ducks were the hottest thing in town for 10 years, and they were so hot that they burned every bridge locally that there was. And you know, there's been a lot of those scenarios where you've seen those teams, you know, that are kind of a flash in the pan and didn't hold on. And you know, for every one of those, there's also a San Jose Sharks, which is one of the best game day environments going, which makes no sense to me because San Jose is not a very big sports town. I mean, mostly it's based in San Francisco. But hockey fans from the East Coast would be shocked if they went to a Sharks game. People do not stand up during the game, and they're all sold out. So I don't know with Vegas. You know, I think they're going to make it awfully difficult for Seattle to be appeased by the NHL.
Right. Well, in fact, you know, my opinion, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, I felt like, at least in my research, San Jose has always just kind of stuck to what they're supposed to do. And not only that, they've always treated their fan bases really well, as opposed to some groups that when they achieve success, then they got a little cocky with the success, raised the ticket prices, did this, did that, went for the quick cash money grab. San Jose didn't do that. Am I right or wrong about that?
No, that's exactly. So the Anaheim Ducks are regularly talked about in the NHL circles, at least when I was there 10, 15 years ago, about how not to do things when you're on top. Right. They basically were so hot that they felt untouchable and that was never going to change. And some of the moves they made on the business side made it very difficult for them to maintain a fan base when they, you know, eventually came back down. I mean, the leagues are all based on parity. Yeah, there are some Patriots level dynasties in some leagues, but they're all built to not stay good forever. And, you know, it's just fascinating to see that. I'll be interested to see what happens with the Winnipeg Jets too. They're actually really trying to tread that line. They've got a very, very, interested and engaged fan base, but the reality is they don't have a lot of corporate dollars there, so that fan base has to stay up. They are one of the teams that relies on ticket sales. And, you know, that won't be new again in a couple of years. So, you know, all those forces that forced the team out of Winnipeg in the first place, are they gonna put enough pressure on it in the second time around? So who knows? And that's just the interesting play with hockey right now, right? Is you have these moves that some of them go well. Some of them turn into the Arizona Coyotes. You know?
Yes. Yes, I saw their arena just 3.5-4 months ago. So.
beautiful arena. It's a beautiful place, but that's not a hockey town, and it never, ever will be.
No. Never will be.
Tony, like Miami.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's the interesting part. Miami and baseball, that's one where I can understand why Major League Baseball wanted to give it a shot there, but it doesn't work there.
No, it does not work. And that new stadium, I mean, he basically fleeced the local government on that. That's a story for another day. But
yes,
I don't. You know, it's one of those things where you wonder who's in the room saying, "Yeah, let's award a franchise to Miami," because
well,
that's going to work.
There wasn't you and me in the room because we would have given him different advice. Tony, absolute pleasure. Even with the cold, you were still 98 on the slow gun.
I like it.
Thanks, my friend. It's always, always great to hear. Can't wait to talk to you again.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Tony Knapp. Today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. We're in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.